This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
A search for the truth behind an international drug smuggling plot.
How are we going to unravel this all?
From the BBC World Service, this is World of Secrets, Season 5, Finding Mr. Fox. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Der Dezember steckt voller Gewinne mit dem Rubbellos Adventskalender. 24 mal rubbeln, 24 mal die Chance auf festliche Sofortgewinne. Mit Gesamtgewinnen von mehr als 4,5 Millionen Euro über alle Winterlose hinweg. Ich bin dann mal weg.
Rubbellose, das schnellste Glück von Lotto. Chance auf einen der Höchstgewinne, siehe Rückseite der Lose.
Hello, I'm Charles Gitonga, and here's what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. Electronic waste, or e-waste, is a huge problem for many African countries. Today, we look at the impact it has on lives in Ghana and how criminal networks are involved in trafficking it from Western countries.
Sending countries can sign a document with a contractor who represents that the company will properly dispose of the plastic waste. But instead of properly disposing, the company will improperly and illegally dump the waste, which then means they get to pocket the profit that they received.
And why Somalia's finance minister is hopeful that the country is in strong financial standing following a debt forgiveness program that saw nearly $5 billion wiped off its books.
We have been able to re-engage with international financial institutions, notably the World Bank and African Development Bank, and we have been able to unlock new finances for social spending, including human capital development, investment in education, in health.
It's Thursday, the 21st of November. First, we talk matters G20. The summit, held in Brazil, marks a significant moment as South Africa assumes the G20 presidency. It is the first African country to do so. The group was established in 1999 and focuses on solving global economic and financial issues, but has expanded its agenda to include topics like sustainable development, climate change, and health. South Africa is the only permanent African member of the 19-nation group, which includes major economies like the US, China, and Germany, alongside two regional blocs, the African Union and the European Union. The AU's attainment of permanent membership in the G20 last year was seen as a historic step towards amplifying Africa's voice in global decision-making, and South Africa hopes to build on these efforts.
I'm honored to welcome all of you to South Africa in the coming year 2025. Lastly, I'd like to thank you all for giving South Africa this great opportunity of being president of the G20. We will work with you to achieve its objectives. So thank you very much. Nante bedale.
That was South African President Cyril Ramaphosa. Now, other African countries such as Angola, Egypt, Mozambique, Nigeria, and Tanzania were invited to participate in this year's summit in Brazil. But the key question is whether the G20 can now deliver tangible results that address Africa's challenges such as poverty, climate change, and economic development. I've been speaking to Professor Daniel D. Bradlow, Senior Research Fellow at the Center for the Advancement of Scholarship at the University of Pretoria. The reason we are having this conversation is because South Africa is going to assume the presidency of the G20 next year, and they will also host the next summit. How might this then impact the country and also the continent? Because they have 1 year. It's a very short period of time. What can they do with it?
So it's a very short period of time, and I think there's a limit to what you can do with it, but the risks are also quite high in the sense that being the president of the G20 means the spotlight of the world will be on South Africa really for the year. And over the course of that year, there are about 130 meetings at ministerial level and at technical official level that will be taking place in South Africa. That means it's going to be the biggest international event in South Africa's history, really ever. because the other big events like the World Cup or the funeral of President Mandela were one-off events. This is going on for the whole year. And so if South Africa does a good job of managing that, it gives, you know, you're going to have thousands of people coming to the country and they're going to all go back and say what a great experience they had and how effective the country was in managing that. And reputationally and economically, that can have some important benefits for South Africa, as well as for the region and the continent, because it helps raise the reputation and people's sense that Africa can do a good job of managing complicated international events. So that's level number one. Level number two is South Africa has the opportunity to influence the global agenda at the G20. Doesn't have complete control over the agenda because it inherits some issues from what Brazil and previous chairs have done, but it does have the opportunity to raise issues and to have them put on the agenda and discussed in ways that would not necessarily happen otherwise. So, for example, if you looked at the Brazilian chair this year, President Lula created the Global Alliance on Hunger and Poverty, which is a new initiative that didn't achieve anything practical in the sense other than you've created an initiative with over 80 countries, many international organizations, philanthropies in participating in it. And that becomes a platform that he can take forward to deal with these issues. So on issues of concern to Africa, South Africa can do something similar. So on debt, on development finance, on climate, food security, regional integration, those sorts of issues, South Africa can raise the profile and can initiate actions, some of which will come to fruition hopefully within the next year, but some of which might take longer, but still come to fruition eventually.
Professor, how can you and I and, you know, the more than a billion people that live on the African continent really connect with this? Because people are dealing with very real challenges, whether it's the debt problem that many countries have and it's having serious impact on development programs for countries, climate change that's affecting farmers and many other people as well, poverty. How should they connect with this? How should they embrace the fact that now an African country is leading this very important grouping of countries, powerful countries, whose mandate is to deal with these very challenges?
This is a wonderful opportunity for Africa, but finding the avenues into the discussions is a bit of a challenge. It's made easier by the fact that there are a number of what are called engagement groups that are connected to the G20. So, for example, there's one for think tanks, there's one for civil society, one for business, one for labor, one for women, there's a youth group. So those groups have representatives from each of the G20 countries. And those groups can, in the case of Africa, can feed in either through the South African networks or through the African Union networks. And they have meetings and they issue their own declaration. So the Youth 20 might issue its own declaration, which then gets fed into the G20 process. So that's one way of doing it. Next year is also an important year because it's the Financing for Development Conference, the fourth Financing for Development Conference that will take place in Sevilla in June, July next year. And that also deals with the finance issues, which are going to be critical for Africa and for the G20 next year. And so using that as another channel is a way in which people can connect. But I think on top of that, people need, to the extent that it's feasible, is to lobby their governments to raise the issues. For example, President Ruto has been quite effective in raising international issues in other international forums, not the G20, because Kenya is not a member of the G20. But the fact that he participates in raising those issues and does it with leaders from the G20 means that those initiatives feed into the G20 process as well. So there are all these different angles of getting the message through and of making it clear to the other G20 leaders that the need to deal with these problems in Africa is in everybody's interest, not just our interest as Africans.
So then if we are to make a list of priorities that African countries need to highlight under this period where South Africa has the G20 presidency, what do you think should make that list?
I mean, for us, the biggest issues as a continent are the debt and development financing issues. But that's tied to reaching the sustainable development goals and to dealing with climate. So the financing issue is number one. The second issue is, how do we link that those issues to making sure that there's money that's going to be used effectively to deal with meeting the sustainable development goals, so that we're able to give every person in Africa a reasonable opportunity of having a decent and life filled with opportunity and dignity, is the second issue. Third issue are sort of more practical issues of dealing with climate loss and damage, to deal with food security, to raise the issues of some of the reparation issues from colonial history that need to be addressed in some way. It's a difficult discussion, and you can debate which is the best forums for doing it, but raising those sorts of issues becomes important. South Africa's made as its theme for the year solidarity, inequality, and sustainability. And that captures these ideas, but we need to make it more concrete, talking about debt, through talking about development finance, climate finance, fair trade arrangements. The other issue, which is very important for Africa, is illicit financial flows. So all of those issues should come up in some way. They're on the agenda, but South Africa can raise their profile and can put forward concrete plans for how to make them more sustainable and more equitable for Africa.
Yeah. And Professor, not everyone is optimistic about, you know, these types of groupings, you know, of powerful countries and what they can do, because these arguments that I'm sure you'd have heard, that summits like this really do not benefit Africa. There's a lot of talking and little action. So in terms of policy or even long-term geopolitical influence, how would you speak to that as to what Africa would gain from this?
I mean, I think many of those criticisms are valid, but I think one also has to be realistic. International affairs is a very complicated business. The distribution of power in the world is very unequal. Africa has a limited voice because of the size of its economy. We have a lot of people, but that doesn't translate into power in economic or military terms. I always tell people that international affairs, you have to measure progress in millimeters, not centimeters, and accept that this is only one arena in which change can happen. And so that in that we can make some progress, it's very limited progress, but that doesn't suggest that we should give up on the major area where we need change, which is often at the domestic level. And the two have to work together, so that at what we can expect from the international level is a limited amount, but we need to keep pushing to achieve what we can and to make the reforms and changes that we need to make a more fair and just international system.
All right. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Good talking to you.
Professor Daniel D. Bradlow, Senior Research Fellow at the Center for the Advancement of Scholarship at the University of Pretoria. Have you ever wondered what really happens to your phone, television set, or the microwave once they are spoiled and no longer useful? Ideally, these items should be disposed of in a very particular way because they contain metals and plastics that could be harmful to people and the environment. But that doesn't necessarily happen. Instead, these items are being trafficked from developed countries to the global south, to countries like Ghana. New findings show that electrical and electronic waste, or e-waste, has become the world's most frequently seized item by custom officials. The BBC's environment correspondent, Naveen Singh Kadka, went to Ghana's capital, Accra, to report on how e-waste is a source of very harmful plastic pollution, and he's been speaking to me on what he saw.
As soon as I landed there and when we started rolling in that filming and recording, it was the way towards that place, a very, very colorful, massive market and things that I didn't see anywhere else. Imagine lorries and trucks full of palantines, yam. And what fascinated me was women, you know, in colorful dresses, and they were kind of carrying all these different things, fish, fruits, and so enterprising, so energetic. I mean, it really was very colorful. I mean, I really wanted to talk to them, you know, but my story was somewhere else and that took me away.
So let's talk about what or the reason why you are there then, which is to look into this e-waste trafficking. What new or surprising finding did you come up with or did you see there?
So not so far away from this buzzing market, colourful market, is this place called Agbogbloshie Scrapyard, a massive, massive mountain of all kind of waste, including e-waste, particularly from rich countries. And the new thing, what you, like you rightly said, this has been reported so many times in the past. What kind of really, really surprised me was this was actually shut down, to borrow the government's, Ghanaian government's word, abolished, back in 2021. But then it's back. It's in full swing. People are still doing what they did in the past. And also, my limited research was that most of the time, we were talking about burning off plastic cables. But what I found was it was not just that. That mountain of dump, what I've been talking about, by the way, it's got a concoction of stench. Imagine everything coming out of it. You can't actually breathe there. So from there, what workers do is they literally dig that place and then, bring out the computer cases, plastic TV cases, refrigerator cases, washing machine cases, and bring them down to burn and to extract precious metals like copper or even gold from different things, including car parts and so on and so forth. So I think to me, when these guys went again up and bring down those things and burning, that was something very, very new to me. And as I said, I didn't expect that this place was up and running despite government closing it down back in 2021. We were also talking to other places, for example, Malaysia, that kind of imports e-waste, or let's say Thailand, Southeast Asia. And this is where the UN has focused its attention for now, because this has remained the hub. After China banned all kind of waste, these countries started taking in all these kind of waste, including e-waste. But they are clamping down as well. And that's why UN authorities, including Masood Karmipour, who is the head of the Asia-Pacific head with the UN Office on Drugs and Crime based in Bangkok. He told us now things are moving towards Africa, but it is basically now a massive, massive organized crime.
With those kinds of profits in play, there's great incentive for organized crime activity to step in. Sending countries can sign a document with a contractor who represents that the company will properly dispose of the plastic waste. But instead of properly disposing, the company will improperly and illegally dump the waste, which then means they get to pocket the profit that they received from the sending countries.
Right. So that's Masood Karmipour with the UN Office on Drugs and Crime. Navin, tell me, you mentioned about organized crime profiting from e-waste trafficking. How do these networks operate, and can governments do anything to dismantle them?
So you see, when we talk to different quarters, including Masood from the UN Office on Drugs and Crime, they talk about things like use of cryptocurrencies. Can you imagine these people, these traffickers? And then also things like, for example, right in the middle of the ocean, when they find that, they cannot take these things to the destination where they had hoped for, because, the person who was supposed to be there is not there, or the government at the recipient country is not willing to take it. So what they do is they turn their beacons, the vessel's beacons off, so that they cannot be tracked. And then Masood also told me that, those waste are dumped right in the middle of the sea. And authorities, port authorities elsewhere, let's say in Naples where we filmed, or in the UK, Felixstowe Port, they showed us, they explained to us how traffickers literally grind e-waste and mix up with plastic wastes. And that's how they traffic them away, showing that these are just simple plastic waste. But Masood, he had the best, the way he explained about cryptocurrency was fascinating.
Criminal groups, through the use of cryptocurrencies, launder their profits. And law enforcement needs to do more to become more tech savvy. A business model of organized crime activity is to take shipment from well-intentioned Western countries who pay for proper disposal and then turn around and have organized crime dump them illegally into the ocean.
But then talk to us about regulations. They can be international or local rules that sort of guide the world and countries in Africa and elsewhere into knowing that e-waste is really a problem and things that can help these countries deal with this problem as well.
So you see, like the port officials that we were talking about, they all the time tell us that mostly people misdeclare these goods as personal goods that are reusable, and that's how they try to traffic that. And also, you know, mixing up, grinding those e-waste and mixing up with plastic flakes and trying to traffic them out. These tricks, you know, these tactics have been at play. Now, what I've been told by authorities and experts is there's this international convention called the Basel Convention that kind of takes care of all these hazardous substances, hazardous waste. So because traffickers are exploiting these loopholes, so beginning January, there's been this amendment which is coming into effect beginning January 2025, under which what happens is exporters will have to declare anything, whether it's hazardous, non-hazardous, e-waste. They just can't say it's reusable goods, personal goods. They'll have to say it is e-waste. That's the first trigger. And then the recipient countries, wherever they are taking it, they will have to secure a consent, a permission of entry from the recipient country. That is going to be applicable. That is going to come into effect beginning January 2025. So that is where all these authorities or policymakers, investigators, they are pinning their hopes on. But here's the thing. Not all countries have signed up to this Basel Convention. For example, the US has not signed up to it. And the US is also a major e-waste exporter. And I'm told that much of its waste is also now going towards Africa. So because of all these findings, we tried our best to get a response from the Ghanaian authority, from the port officials, or from the environment agency, environment ministry. We repeatedly wrote emails to them, and we even doorstepped the ministry, where this is called the Ghanaian Authority on Revenue Authority, GRA, as it is known. But we received no response, not at all.
Naveen Sinkadka, the BBC's environment correspondent. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
Hello, I'm Simon Jack.
And I'm Zing Sing.
And together we host Good Bad Billionaire, the podcast exploring the minds, the motives and the money of some of the world's richest individuals.
Every episode we pick a billionaire and we find out how they made their money.
And then we judge them. Are they good, bad or just another billionaire?
Good Bad Billionaire from the BBC World Service.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Let's go to Somalia now and talk about debt relief. As you already know, this is a country that has been through very difficult times. From a dictatorship of President Mohamed Siad Barre from 1969 to 1991, to a bloody civil war that broke out shortly after his ouster and lasted for decades. In 2012, an internationally backed government was installed. The decades of instability in Somalia brought the economy to its knees. However, the last decade has been spent trying to rebuild the country, and key to these efforts being addressing Somalia's external debt, which stood at more than $5 billion in 2018. Given the low levels of economic activity in the country caused by insecurity and political instability, it was almost certain that Somalia could never repay its creditors. So in the last 1 year, the country's efforts to have its debt forgiven have borne some fruits. I've been speaking to Somalia's finance minister, Behi Iman Ege, who started by telling us how the country became so indebted in the first place. Could you start by establishing for us how Somalia ended up with a lot of debt, and how much debt are we talking about?
Somalia has endured close to three decades of collapse of the central government of Somalia. It has endured a prolonged civil conflict that severely disturbed economic stability and governance. The absence of functional government stalled economic development and impeded effective debt management. So during 1970s and 1980s, Somalia accrued substantial loans from international lenders, both multilateral and bilateral donors. So these loans often allocated for military expenditure or infrastructure projects failed to generate substantial growth and eventually led to the final collapse of the state. By the time of the collapse, Somalia was burdened with a debt stock of approximately $5.3 billion, predominantly owed to multilateral creditors such as the United States, Italy, France, Netherlands, Spain, and many other Paris Club members.
The debt has now been forgiven, or much of it has been. Talk to us how much exactly has been forgiven and who is forgiving this debt.
Somalia has secured a debt forgiveness amounting to approximately $4.5 billion. This milestone represents a significant reduction in the country's debt burden, creating much-needed fiscal space to invest in critical services and infrastructure. So the debt relief process was a collaborative effort involving key stakeholders, including multilateral institutions such as the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, who played a pivotal role in facilitating the debt relief process. Bilateral creditors has also played a key role, including Paris Club members, as I mentioned earlier. Major creditors were the United States, which has forgiven more than $1.14 billion U.S. dollars. Russia has also forgiven close to $700 million. France, Italy, UK, Germany, Spain, Netherlands, and Nordic countries like Norway and Denmark, Sweden have also canceled their debt obligations from Somalia. You know, there has been a policy conditionalities that was tied to the debt cancellation process, which were mainly reforms that were expected from Somalia to undertake. So that journey has not only been a debt cancellation process, but it has been a state building process. Mm-hmm.
So could you then, just on the same breath, spell out for us some of these reforms that Somalia has had to do to make these creditors comfortable to cancel this debt?
We have undertaken drastic reforms that actually encompasses different aspects of governance. We have driven public financial management reforms that instill a sense of accountability and transparency in our financial management. We have also engendered financial sector reforms. At the moment, the central bank is a premier policy institution that drives our financial sector regulation and reforms. We have also undertaken deep security sector reforms, where we have been able to remove all redundancies and ghost soldiers from our security bureau. We have also undertaken drastic reforms regarding on tax administration, revenue administration. So through those years, we have been able to increase our domestic revenue from 1% of the GDP to 3% of the GDP. We have started at a very, very low base, but we continue to grow our domestic revenue. So the reforms, in fact, has been wide-ranging, and they have been painstaking reforms, but beneficial ones.
How is this then really improving the lives of Somalia citizens? And I would like you to talk about how you are translating the money that could have gone to paying this debt and the interest to improving the daily lives of people in Somalia.
You know, Somalia was in default. So we were not actually servicing. We were not paying any debts to our creditors. So the fact that we were in default. But the cancellation of this debt has unlocked new external resources for us. We have been able to re-engage with international financial institutions, notably the World Bank and African Development Bank, and we have been able to unlock new finances for social spending, including human capital development, investment in education, in health, in infrastructure, particularly energy and digital connectivity. So this clearance of arrears have actually enabled Somalia to access these external resources that has impacted the lives of millions of Somalis. And as you know, Somalia was fraught with a number of challenges, security challenges, cyclical and recurrent climatic challenges. So without these external resources, it would have been very difficult to address, these global shocks.
Right. Minister, could you clarify for us what kind of external resources you're talking about? Are we talking about grants or are we talking new loans? What are you exactly working on?
We have become eligible to International Development Association's resources on grant terms, IDA resources on grant terms, as well as also the African Development Bank resources on grant terms. So we're not talking about loans. So Somalia has not accumulated any new arrears since the HIBC compilation process.
And I'll just clarify this for listeners because you've referred to it, HIPIC, which is the Highly Indebted Poor Countries Initiative. And that is an initiative by the World Bank and the IMF to help countries that are perceived to be poor, but also in a lot of debt to help them recover, which is, you know, the way that Somalia has been able to secure this debt cancellation. So tell us then how the plan looks like for Somalia to stay out of the debt trap.
So Somalia's aim is to sustain economic reforms, to prevent unsustainable debt levels. This includes increasing domestic revenue, improving public expenditure, and promoting good governance. The country plans to leverage support from international partners, focusing on inclusive growth and resilience through infrastructure development and private sector engagement.
So let me just follow up on that then. And it's something you said about, you know, you are looking also to improve your revenues, make sure you can generate more money for the government through taxes and other ways from within the country. Are there challenges that you face in this? And particularly if we look at something like insecurity, dealing with Al-Shabaab, for example, one of the things that they are quite known for is approaching businessmen and sort of extorting money from them in form of quote-unquote taxes. Is something like that a distraction to what you're trying to do, making sure that you can collect more revenue in an official manner that can go into helping the country and helping turn lives around in Somalia?
We are fighting and combating with the terrorists. Critical to this is combating terrorist financing. I chair a national committee on combating terrorist financing and anti-money laundering. So through that committee, we have been able to introduce a number of regulations that curb terrorist financing, particularly creating, you know, limitations for them to access extortions and terrorist finance. So, and on the other hand, as you know, the government has also waged a war against Al-Shabaab 2 years ago. And we have liberated large swaths of territories from Al-Shabaab. So we have exerted a pressure militarily, financially, as well as also ideologically. So that those efforts are also improving or contributing to our revenue mobilization efforts.
Thank you very much, Minister, for making time to speak with us. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bihi Iman Ege, Somalia's Minister of Finance. Focus on Africa was put together by Blessing Aderoba in Lagos. Bella Hassan, Amy Leibovitz, and Joseph Keane were in London. Paul Bachibinga was a senior producer, and Philip Bull was our technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Muthengi are our editors. And by the way, we are also on YouTube. Do check us out. Before I go, a quick reminder that you should listen to our sister podcast, Africa Daily. The next episode focuses on the protests in Mozambique. I'm Charles Gitonga. We'll talk again next time.
Hello, I'm Simon Jack.
And I'm Sing Sing.
And together we host Good Bad Billionaire, the podcast exploring the minds, the motives, and the money of some of the world's richest individuals.
Every episode we pick a billionaire and we find out how they made their money.
And then we judge them. Are they good, bad, or just another billionaire?
Good Bad Billionaire from the BBC World Service.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.